Hello, 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 Favi Fav here. Now, today I bring you a very special episode. Well, actually, it's an episode of another podcast, which is called The Art People Podcast. Some of you may know I have a whole nother podcast. And so on my travels, installing art, I do big installation work, if y'all don't know. I get to meet a lot of really great people, and I get to interview a lot of people. And it's one of my favorite things to do is connecting with these amazing art people from all around. And, you know, Latinos Who Lunch is a great platform to air those interviews, but sometimes there's just no time to do it with Babelito or, you know, to coordinate the interviews. So I said, I need a whole nother platform to put interviews there. And I have interviewed a lot of Latino artists. So if you want to go check it out, I think we're about 21, 22 episodes deep in the Art People Podcast. But this specific interview, our friend Juan Antonio Fernandez, who we've mentioned on the podcast several times, did an interview with me for Art People Podcast. And I thought, you know what? I want the Latinos Who Lunch listeners to hear this because I think he's such an important figure. He's a really great friend of the pod. And so I'm bringing you the episode that we did on our feed today. So I hope you enjoy. And without further ado, Juan Antonio Fernandez on the Art People Podcast. Hi, I'm Justin Favela, and this is the Art People Podcast. It's the podcast about art. People, get it? Okay. On this show, I bring you the conversations I have with art people in my hometown of Las Vegas and the folks I get to meet on my travels around the world. In December of 2018, I was in Oakland, California, and I got the chance to sit down and talk to cultural producer, media scholar, and full-time joto, Juan Antonio Fernandez. Listen in as we talk about the 90s in LA, producing shows in New York, academics, party lines, Instagram archives, and much, much more. Also, we were at his house and we were eating Cheetos. So if you don't like the sound of people eating Cheetos, maybe fast forward 30 seconds starting now. Cheetos are probably not the best snacks to have while you're interviewing somebody.
Into a microphone.
Yeah, this is
it's gonna be an ASMR.
Yeah, let's see that. Let me grab the bowl. This is the bowl. And this is two Cheetos at once.
Now three.
I really love these Cheetos. Okay, let's talk. Juan.
Yes. Are you recording already?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay.
That red light means recording.
Oh, yeah. It like blinks if it's not recording.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I learned that the hard way when I interviewed Tammy Brown.
Oh, no.
I thought I interviewed Tammy Brown, and then it didn't record any of the
Do you want to interview Tammy Brown?
Huh?
Do you want to interview Tammy Brown?
Yeah. Well, I was at DragCon.
Okay.
And I tried to interview her, but my thing was, I interviewed her for like 5 minutes.
Okay.
But my thing wasn't recording. So sad.
The last DragCon, my friend Joe is good friends with her.
And oh, really?
And he was like working the booth with her.
Oh,
and
cool.
And so my friend Jesse, who was doing a piece for the New Yorker, like,
yeah,
we were able to get a little thing from Tammy.
Yeah, you're very well connected. You know so many people.
Yeah, sometimes by accident. But yeah, I guess I do.
I know people. So I guess on the show, I've been trying to like label people three things.
Mm-hmm.
Like on the first episode, it was Babelito, and it was like Emmanuel Ortega, art historian, curator, podcaster.
Right.
The second episode was Pilar. She's a printmaker, a visual artist, and a community leader. So what are your three things?
My three things?
If you were to choose three things.
Okay. So homosexual.
Gay.
So I would say, well, scholar, thinker, and producer.
Yeah. Well, let's get into that.
Yeah. And gray, right? Like we were talking before, like the gray area, right? Yeah. Like is really like a space, like an idea that I'm trying to, I wouldn't say embody, but like definitely own.
Yeah.
Because I think that I spent so much time trying to work on my spiel and on my like, what am I, right? Like the identity, right?
Yeah.
Like the three things. And I'm finding that I'm most comfortable when I'm not like having to perform any of those identities, where I can just kind of be a person who likes to make connections and make use of my resources and the people that I know and like space, right? Like when I was in New York, somebody who owns a theater space in the Bronx was like, you can use our space. And so it's like, how can I use this space? And that's, you know, and then I did Movida, right? And so I did like a storytelling project where I invited like people to come and like do live storytelling with performance. But it wasn't that like I had originally wanted to curate that concept. It was that I had access to a space. How can I use it? Right? And so it's a lot of that, right?
Yeah.
So I get really uncomfortable when I start to just kind of hone in on one, like artist, right?
Yeah.
Or like the producer or a producer or, you know, writer, scholar, academic. It's like I can't fully embody all of those things at once. I feel like I have to like give myself the room to flux, right?
Yeah, I like that. Well, let's get into your academic background first, because I think that's a cool foundation. Where are you from originally, though? Because you're not from Oakland, right?
No, I'm not from Oakland.
Yeah.
I'm from California, but I'm not from Oakland. I'm from Pacoima,
okay,
LA.
All right.
And I grew up in the Valley in Pacoima. I grew up in Pacoima. I have like four sisters. They're all older, and they all have, you know, a bunch of kids now. But I grew up in Pacoima, and it was a really isolated place. My sisters were really had to deal with a lot of shit, and they had to deal with a lot of racism. And so for them, it was really important for me to like not have an accent. And so I learned English through pop culture, and I learned how, you know what I mean? And I learned how to not have an accent on purpose. Like that was something that I was like raised with, that because of their own issues and there was no internet, there was no empowerment, right? Like they had to survive and navigate. And so for them, I think the idea was that if they can show me how to navigate the world that they had, that they were, you know, that the way that they had to, that life would be easier. So I grew up watching like 80s movies, right? Like problematic ass 80s movies. You know, I think I started coming into my identity in like junior high, and I was like outed by a teacher. And I think that it was like a curse and a blessing, because on one hand, it was like my whole social world opened to this whole other place. Like, you know, I started going to Arena and these nightclubs, but then also my home life, like, you know, the love and affection that I was getting at home, like completely disappeared.
Oh, shit.
As soon as.
How were you outed? What did they find?
There was a teacher in junior high,
yeah,
who had like a parent teacher conference, and my sister had to go translate for my mom, and so like my sister had to translate to my mom that my teacher was telling her that I was gay, because the teacher had overheard conversations with friends and whatever, so there was no way for me to even process my own like sexuality, because you know what I mean, because it was just kind of like, and I think that my uncle had passed of AIDS in the late 80s, and so I think that really affected the way that my mom reacted, because he was her friend, you know, and she had that initial reaction back then that everyone was having, like if he came over, it's like you throw away all the dishes, you like anything that he touched is like scrub it with alcohol, like that really was the way that we were, you know, that my mom was react, but it was society was reacting that way, you
people
know,
or uneducated,
and so all of those things, she really like it was just like her biggest fear, right? So I can't blame her, and like we're cool, like we're super cool now, but like you know, but it was rough. And so shortly after, you know, like I met this girl, her name was Beatrice, and she was like butch, a queer chick at school. Sorry, I said chick. And I'm from the 90s. and that's not an excuse. So she...
I like you, like, correcting yourself. Like, checking yourself. I'm watching it happen all in front of me.
I'm growing.
Look at you.
Growth. She took us to Arena. We, like, snuck out one night and, like, took the bus, like, 2 hours into Hollywood. And we're out. And it was the first time I seen gay people en masse. And, like, and, like, Latinos, right? Like, it wasn't, like... It wasn't just, like, gay people. It was, like, Latinos, like, gay Latinos from all over L.A. It was this all-ages club. I met my first boyfriend that night.
Wow.
Yeah, like, it was crazy. Like,
and it was an all-ages club, right?
Yeah, it was an all-ages club in Hollywood. Yeah. And there was, so Circus Disco was behind it, and that was, like, 21 and over. And then you had Arena on Santa Monica, which was, like, at that time, all-ages. And it was, like... For that little while, it was really like a utopia, right? Like, it was like, I made a lot of friends and I met a lot of people, and it was like pre-Instagram, pre-internet. So like, you really had to like utilize phones, and like, you were calling people. And I remember one time, like, all of a sudden, this other person named Rosie, like, just kind of called me randomly and was like, because my friends called me Johnny back then. And they were like, because my family called me Johnny, but they were like, she called and was like, you're Johnny, right? You live in Pacoima? It's like, yeah. And she's like, I'm a lesbian too. Like, I'm having a kickback. You should come over. I got your number from so-and-so. And like, it was just like, and so then it was like this little network of people that lived in my neighborhood started meeting through all of these other networks of people that like were partying at Arena, right? And so eventually, over a really quick time, you know, by the time I was in ninth grade, it was like caravans of us just like going to Arena. By the time I was in ninth grade, and
oh my gosh, I can't even imagine.
And so that was, you know, that was just kind of
early 90s.
It was like, yeah, like it was like 92 93. Okay. Until the fucking wheels fell off, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I just did that forever and like for a long time. So yeah, so that's kind of like where I'm from and like where I come from, right? And what I come from. And it's been a really interesting thing now to see like this resurgence of like people talking about these histories, you know, and historicizing it. You know, I have friends that are like writing books and doing all of this work on like on historicizing Arena, or like historicizing, you know, Latinidad in the 90s. And so I think, you know, it's a beautiful thing to see because I survived, right? Like, not everyone did. I lost a lot of friends. And so like, and it's nice to revisit it now and have like a more positive affection towards that time.
Yeah.
All of that to say that I didn't graduate high school. So I didn't have like my academic career didn't start till much later. It happened shortly after I got sober. I hit a wall. Like, you know, I was partying, you know, and like my lifestyle revolved around all of that. Like, you know, I was like a tweaker and I was drinking all the time and just like things snowballed. So that by the time I was like 28, I looked like, you know, I was like this haggard, like just messy person who was not fucking fun to be around.
Ugh.
It was dark, but I got clean. I survived. And that was like kind of like the first major shift in my life. Right. It was like, I came out at 14 and then at 28, I got clean or sober. I got sober. I shouldn't say clean. See, I'm checking myself. And, and I got sober, and then that opened kind of all possibilities, you know, because I was like, just kind of restarting my life privately, and I could kind of do anything, right?
Yeah. And what were you doing in that time, like in your 20s?
Partying.
Just partying.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
In California?
In LA.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, but it was dark. It wasn't like even fun. It was just survival, you know, and there was a lot of, I can look back on it now and be glad about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were definitely really dark times and moments where I was just like, fuck, like, I'm probably going to die right now, right? Like jumping in car, right? Like just jumping in random cars and, you know, going to, you know, these older, you know, men's houses and just kind of like shacking up there until they were sick of you. And then you go to the next one. And like, that really was my lifestyle. Right.
Wow.
And so, mm-hmm. And you learn how to survive and perform and navigate life that way, you know? And so I didn't know how to not do that. Getting involved in a sober lifestyle was definitely like needed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somewhere in my 30s, I decided to go back to community college. And it was back then, you still didn't need like a high school diploma to go to community college. You could just like take classes. And I started excelling. Community college, graduate community college, transferred into UCLA. Graduated in 2015. And then went to grad school in New York and did a media studies program at Queens College. And I think definitely UCLA was when I was able to really start looking at these at my own personal history and at all of that like dark stuff in a new light, and to like reshift and reframe how I was thinking about those experiences, right? And not in a glorifying way, and not to say that it was like fabulous, but enough to say that like there's a history there, and I wasn't the only one who experienced these things.
Yeah.
And how do we make these connections and tell these stories, right? You know, and it's like not one dimensional. I mean, there was so many scenes that I was a part of. I definitely made like good use of my time in New York, and I was there for a couple years, and I feel like it was like a duck to water in New York. Like I just immediately fell in love with the people that I was meeting, and it was like a really fertile time, right?
Yeah.
So it was like I was able to like collaborate with people and make stuff and make things happen. I did Movida at the Bronx Academy of Arts and Dance. I did the zine Querida, and I gave and that allowed me to do a talk here. And I worked with the Bronx Museum and moderated some talks, and it just got me really proactive in thinking of how I can utilize all of my experiences, right?
Yeah, let's get into those projects. Tell me about Movida a little bit.
It was like I said, it was just kind of like, it just kind of happened really quick. Like it was shortly after Pulse, and I was experiencing firsthand like the grief that the Puerto Rican community was experiencing, and like the erasure of like the Puerto Rican narrative out of that tragedy. And I had been talking a lot to my friends, and so I had I gathered some good people that I already was hanging out with in New York, Luis Fonseca, who does the Gran Varones, and my friend Jose Roldan, who's an actor, Bianca Laureano, who's like a sexologist scholar and like fucking fierce, and Charles Rice Gonzalez, who's a writer, and he runs the theater space. And I just kind of rallied everyone up and was like, let's do something, like let's tell our story. So the first event was a storytelling project of like your first, like tell the story of your first Latin night, right? Like at your first Latin night. And it was really fun, and it was like a packed house, and people came and were like really enthusiastic. And then the second installment was Yosimar did like a test run. Yosimar Reyes did a test run of Prieto
in the Bronx. Oh, wow.
And like a workshop, kind of a test run of it.
Cool.
With along with Dino Fox, who is now Bay Area based. And Dino Fox does like queer burlesque. And that was fucking fierce. It was so cool. Like Dino Fox is fierce. And so yeah, and it was just like two installments, but it was really like fruitful and just exciting to like produce, and it got my like my juices flowing in terms of like what it could look like to produce and not feel like it has to be one thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And then a couple years ago Juanga passed away.
Yeah.
And you decided to put together a really cool zine,
yeah,
around his life and his influence.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much. Yeah, you included Latinos Who Lunch in the zine. I think you transcribed one of our episodes.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did a special episode for you.
Yeah, but no, Babelito transcribed it. He was really
Babelito transcribed it.
He was really generous.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He was really generous to do that. And y'all, both of you were really generous to like air that piece.
Yeah.
It was really exciting for me. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, he was like my mom's fave. And so like he's always been in my consciousness. And when we would go to Tonalá, to my mom, where my mom's from, in Mexico, we would go like every summer in the 80s. And Querida had come out one of those summers. And so like the lyrics to that song, Querida, are like embedded in my brain. Like, I've known the lyrics to that song since I was a kid.
Yeah.
It made me reflect on not only him and, like, and how Querida came into my consciousness and how he came into my consciousness, but just my own queerness. And my tía in Tonalá, during those summers, had basically a houseboy, right? And she ran like a menudo stand, and so he was like her guy, you know. And he was like this big queen, like he had a big fro, and he wore tight 70s clothes. It was like the 80s, and he wore like tight polyester, and he was really, really, like, you know, fierce. And like, and he got a lot of shit though, but he was really like proud. Like, he was really like, he wasn't trying to hide any of this, you know. There's like Tonalá in the 80s, and he disappeared. Like, he just disappeared, and so they don't know his fate. So all of those things were kind of ruminating when Juanga died. And so when Yasmin Villarreal, who's like she's a journalist in LA, hit me up and said, hey, like, I want to invite you to do this talk about Juanga, like, it really helped get that project going, because I wanted to do everything. Like, yeah. You know, it was really meaningful. And so, like, it was one of those things where, like, you just kind of, like, the project is guiding you, like, you're not really doing, like, it's, mm-hmm. it, like, takes over you. And so I was like, I'm just gonna fucking call everyone and that I know will want to do this, right, or participate. And so, like, I hit up you guys, Gabriel Garcia Roman, like, ugh, fierce. Like,
I love his work.
Yeah, he's...
Yes.
He was, like, a touchstone when I was in New York. Like, he was so fucking cool to just, like, spend time with. Like, he's so chill and, like...
I know.
And
I was kind of starstruck when I met him in New York this last time.
Oh, yeah.
I was, like, too shy to, like, actually engage in conversation. But we hung out.
Yeah.
It was cool. We hung out.
What I loved when I first met him was that, like, I wasn't nervous to meet him because he had already been, like, producing mm-hmm. work. And so it wasn't so much... But he made it easy to talk, but we, like... had like a full, it was like as if we'd known each other for a long time. Like, we were talking about our relationships and like our Latinidad and our queerness and like all of these things and like failed relationships and our party lives. Like, we talked about everything, like, at a coffee shop, like, the first day I met him. So, like, we became quick friends, and like and he let me use a piece that he had made of Juanga for the cover, which I was lucky enough to, like, be able to print in color so that you would get the full effect of it. Claudia Rodriguez, a poet. Rogelio CDA? Do you know who that is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the collage artist. Let me use his Juanga collage for it. And Dorian Wood did an original piece for it. Manuel Paul, my friend Manuel Paul of Santi Ali Trade, let me use some Juanga images that he had made, some graphic art that he had made previous. So it was just like working with a bunch of friends, you mm-hmm. know. And so then I got, you know, and then I went and I, you know, I did this talk and I curated a whole performance piece around it. So then Dorian Wood and Oscar from Sisters Mantos and Sancha came out and, like, sang some did some Juanga covers to coincide with, like, the release of the zine at this talk that we did.
Wow.
And then Yasmin screened a short doc that she'd made that was awesome, following impersonators, Juanga impersonators. Yeah, it was a fucking dope event. It was really fun. I mean, you know, it was just like, what do you do when you lose someone like that? You know, like, how do you like honor someone that's so special? And so it felt really good. And my sisters came, and, you know, my cousin came into the talk, and, you know, just to kind of share that kind of space on this side of my life, right? Like, it was really cool. Yeah.
That's amazing. It's also really amazing how small the art world is.
Yeah.
And specifically, like, the queer Latinx art world.
For sure.
Like, all those people you mentioned, like, yeah. I've crossed paths with them and, like, I'm friends with some of them now, which is so incredible.
Right.
It's incredible.
It's super small.
Yeah.
And everyone's fucking rad. Like, I love Oscar from Sisters Mantos.
Yeah.
Like he's brilliant. And, like, so even when we have, like, quick little text messages or, like, Instagram, you know, chats or whatever, like, it's just, like, it's refreshing, right?
To
know that there are folks out there that, like, think like you, right? And I think it comforts me because, you know, growing up in Pacoima, like, isolated, like, close enough to LA that, like, you can technically get there, but you still live in this place that's, like, way out in the valley, it's a whole other world, you know, and it's like super far away, especially when you're a kid and you don't like, or you're young and you don't have like a car, right? Or like access to, you're like, you're, it's like a whole other world, you know? Now that I get to connect with folks like at this capacity, like it's like feeding that part of me that needed it for so long, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about, well, I have anyway, with different friends, but with you specifically about like different transitions in our lives.
Right.
And I feel like, I mean, we talked about it now, like your transition from, you know, this party animal to to a scholar, to an academic, right? Mm-hmm. And it took kind of sobriety to push you. It was a whole new world for you. And right. I feel like now you're in another place, right, of transition.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Like moving, I immediately just kind of like sunk my toes into the East Coast. I was just like, this is it. Like, it just felt really fertile and like fruitful and like, fuck, I want to do everything right now. And then just kind of like moving to the East, back to the West Coast. Like I have family in the Bay Area. My grandfather lives in San Jose. My cousins live in San Jose, grew up out here. And so, like I definitely have connections to the Bay Area, but I've never lived here. It has allowed me to just kind of retreat and like and do some self-care and like stop and like forced me to stop, right? Mm-hmm. Because I was going like, you know, from the second I started community college, I was like working full-time in retail and then going to school full-time, and I didn't stop. Like I did like winter, spring, summer, fall. Like I was just churning it out, like not stopping. And then I started producing stuff, and so then it was like going, working, going. So landing here, well, first of all, when I had initially got here, I was still working on my thesis, my master's thesis. So like a lot of that early time spent in the Bay Area was me just like holed up in this dining room, like writing and reading and writing and reading and like, you know, yeah. churning out that work. And then it was done. And even then I got a job. And so I was like working at a college full time and then writing my thesis. So over the summer, I was really forced to just kind of stop. And it opened the door for like self-care. Right. And like, what does self-care look like for me now? Because mm-hmm. when I initially, you know, the first time I had ever experienced self-care was like when I was in starting a recovery from drugs and alcohol. And so like, that was kind of laid out for me though. Right. Like those things are really rigid and very like, there's a lot of rules and a lot of things in these programs. And so, which are super helpful and life-saving for people. Never would I diminish that experience. But what it did was it made me really judgmental and really like rigid and like a soldier, right? Like in a scary way, right? Mm. And so everything had to be very regimented and like in a box, right? I've been able to relax here, and it's really uncomfortable because that's hard for, I don't know, for you as like a working artist who's like very proactive.
Yeah.
Like it's hard to just like sit, just take care of
yourself,
how you're feeling that day.
Yeah.
You know? And so now, like I was telling a friend earlier, like I realized that like, I'm way too in touch with my feelings now. Right. You know,
it's the opposite.
Yeah.
You went the other way.
Yeah. Like now it's just kind of like, so now in that, like, in this kind of phase of transition, it's like being okay with imbalance. Being okay with the gray, right? Like with the gray area, with like, with fertility and with like anything, you know, like, but not putting expectations on it this time, where before I had very like tunnel vision, right? Like I'm going to get a master's. Mm-hmm. All right. This is my project. Like, boom, like, and just going at it, like without anything in the periphery, and now allowing myself to just like sit down and like not have to feel like I have to produce anything today, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's hard because then you're just like alone with your thoughts, but like at the end of the day, like our bodies need to like,
I thought about doing the thing where you like unplug on Sundays, like don't get on your phone or check emails or anything.
Right.
I'm going to try that, but I'm already stressed out thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean that was one thing I did in the last few months, was just like not engaging on social media so much, not giving so much away, right? Yeah. And like the last time you were here, I was, my Instagram was deactivated.
I remember that.
Yeah. And like, but it was, you know, like I had to, like, you know, like I don't always have to create content. I don't always have to create, like, I don't have to put everything out there. And I know that there is empowerment in that for some. Personally, at this point in my life, like I need to recharge, and part of that is also just like laying low, and that's uncomfortable sometimes, right?
yeah It's also like the FOMO thing, like fear of missing out.
100%.
I remember I was, this past summer I was feeling really sad because I wasn't with my friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just like had to stop looking at Instagram because mm-hmm. I would get so sad from just like seeing everybody hanging out and I'm just like in some random city doing a whatever, you know,
right,
by myself in like the woods somewhere. So yeah, it definitely is healthy to unplug sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely experienced that when we first moved here. And like, you know, I had left all of this community in New York, and so like just kind of watching them continue on being awesome and like not being able to like be there mm-hmm. to even just to fucking clap for them, right? Like it sucks, you know.
Yeah. So what was your thesis on for your master's?
Funny you should ask. I So I researched the idea of, well, I basically was looking at Instagram archives, right?
Oh, okay.
And so looking at the Instagram archive as like an artistic medium, it was a critique. Mm-hmm. And it was basically, I zeroed in on, I mean, it's pretty complicated, but I was looking at the effects of specific Instagram archives and gentrification and the connections and the process of art washing and how it could have, you know, how these things manifest. And so then looking at Instagram as a site for slumming, like digital slumming. So like when we think of like historically, I think in pop culture, what we think of the most is usually like the Harlem Renaissance, right? And we can see in the history how like white folks occupied, reappropriated jazz, right? or like would go into Harlem and basically watch us, right? Or watch black folks.
Yeah.
And like,
so that's what's happening on Instagram. People are going onto these archives.
Yeah.
And like...
And watching us.
And taking it.
Taking it, reappropriating it, and then going specifically to those sites, right?
And to those people.
And so, and also the fact that like Instagram is like a huge multi-kabillion dollar corporation that is owned by Facebook that is now basically the owner of these images, right? And so it's like, well, how freely are we willing to just like give our personal history up, right? Mm-hmm. And because it's just gonna end up in some database. And so I look at everything that I approach critically, right? And so I just wanted to have that conversation. Really, it was just to pinpoint kind of one way that this could be a problem, right? That like an Instagram page like Veteranas and Rucas, right? That mm-hmm. that is like really fruitful and really, you know, has had a beautiful effect on the community that it's working with. But then there's like folks on the periphery, like, you know, institutions, you know, mainstream institutions, galleries, museums that are looking at it very differently and not the way that we honor it, right? As brown folks, as Latinos, as Chicanx, as Latinx, like, and then also what's left out from that history, right? Because it's like one person that's manning the ship. It's like, well, we can make an argument that, yes, you are bringing light and preserving a history, but where are the black folks that were in this community? Where are the queer folks that mm-hmm. created these communities? I mean, party crews and backyard parties are queer functions, yeah. right? And so I participated in them. So like, I know, you know, and even then, you know, thinking about Arena and being a part of it and experiencing when party crews would come in and like be really hostile towards our spaces. So like there was just, you know, it was just a way for me to process what I experienced personally, you know, given my history, mm-hmm. and then also a way for me to process what I had been studying at the time, and also for me to process the way our histories, you know, I did Chicano studies, Chicano studies at UCLA. So like I was very much embedded. It was very fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
These histories were very fresh in my mind. I had done a project with the Maricon Collective previous where, you know, I like preserved some of the things that they had produced and like, you know, did a whole thing at the Chicano Resource Center at UCLA. And so like these histories were very fresh in my mind. So it was like a natural progression to jump into this project. I still don't feel like I explained it as thoughtfully as I could have, but yeah. But you know, there is this theory of the middle class gaze that a woman, her name escapes me.
Last night I went to the Eagle,
uh-huh.
and there was this drag show happening, and it was like a movie, Juan. These two, it reminded me of like Paris is Burning or something.
Right.
These two white people that look like from the 80s. Mm-hmm. It almost looked like business attire, but maybe it was like business cocktail attire. Mm-hmm. Were there. Like, and it was like a guy with brown hair, a tall man that looked like a lawyer with like kind of like goofy looking white dude with right. in his 40s with what appeared to be his wife who had like that beautiful like helmet hair to like the shoulders, you know what I mean?
Right,
and then
yeah,
she had like a shoulder padded like blazer thing and like a nice like skirt.
With pearls maybe.
Yeah. And they stood at the very front of the drag show at the very, and I was at the very front and they like stood in front of me. Mm-hmm. So I was like watching this drag show in between these two white people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the fuck? What are they doing in the way? And I think what was going on is like they knew one of the Latina, there was all three Latina drag queens. They knew one of them and they were, it was so weird. They were just there to be like, look, we support you. Like, I don't know. Like if I stuck out that much, you know, that's not my space. It's a gay bar. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it was such a weird thing.
Yeah.
And but for them to not even see that they were physically, literally in everybody's way, taking in that experience that wasn't, it's not, it wasn't for them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And so, you know, it's like, so something like that. So then that's perfect.
Yeah.
You know, something like, you know, like an Instagram page, is accessible to everyone, right?
Yeah.
And it's public, right?
Yeah.
It's like hella public. And so like, even though essentially it was made for us, anyone can access it. And eventually, you know, as some of these have ended up in like mainstream institutions. And it's like, well, who's funding this and why? And where is it going to go from here? Right. And then we can easily just look to East LA and Boyle Heights and the struggles that they're having with galleries right now. And it's like, you know, I don't want to get into that whole conversation, but these things don't happen out of thin air. Like mm-hmm. there is a domino effect that occurs, right? It's not that I'm not trying to uplift the artists in our community, but we have to start critiquing ourselves, right? Like we have to start looking at each other and being like, what are we doing? I'll just, you know, I'll say a friend of mine, you know, mentioned, you know, the brown critique of brown art, right? Like, I think it's time. I'm all for and open to people pushing back on any of the work that I've produced on these topics.
Yeah.
But I also would expect that we create the same kind of questions and pushback towards each other as well, right?
Yeah. And also to be careful because I see white supremacy is real.
Right.
And it's very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I see these like very public archives and like very inclusive for the people, for mm-hmm. Latinx people, for queer people,
mm-hmm.
Organizations and communities, they start to have gatekeepers.
Gatekeepers, yeah.
And that's dangerous.
That's so dangerous.
Because, oh my God, I read this quote by Roxane Gay recently that I'm totally going to butcher right now, but I just found it so amazing. She says that she doesn't like to be called an expert because mm-hmm. once you're an expert on something, you're put on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And once you're put on a pedestal, you have to remain very still. so people could admire you, right? Yeah. And it's like,
oh, that's deep. Yeah.
And then you stop growing as a right. person, and you know that's power, and people mm-hmm. are addicted to power. I know that's, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
So that's why I have my own podcast, so, so I can talk about myself. But it's dangerous when you don't reflect on your own community and are critical of your own community. That's what we do a lot in Latinos Who Lunch too, right. you know?
Yeah, no, totally.
And
which I appreciate.
And we're critical within that show itself. But but then also on the other end of that is just like people also give people passes. They're like, oh, they're trying. Mm-hmm. They're Latinos and they're trying. I'm like, yeah, but they're it's bad.
It's bad.
That's bad art.
Yeah.
That was a bad show. I'm never going right. to go. I'm not going to support that anymore.
Or just offensive or tone deaf or,
oh
you
my
know.
God. Can we talk about John Leguizamo's Netflix special?
Girl.
There's case in point.
Yeah, girl.
Like, what?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. I mean, we saw it at Joe's Pub and I think, you know, we left with that initial.
Oh, you saw it live.
Yeah. And so, and we saw it at the Public and, we had left with that initial afterglow of like, isn't it great for us to like finally see ourselves? And by the time we were on the subway, we were like, that was fucking homophobic.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was so like, and ahistorical and like decontextualized. And it was like, for who? Who is this for?
Yeah.
Right. And that's how I feel about, and that's, I think initially what triggered my wanting to work on these archives is that even just the misuse of the idea of an archive, archives are like colonial concepts, right? And like, you know,
that's
like
yeah.
you know, I mean, years and years and centuries of tribes that have had their like artifacts taken from them so that they can be archived in a museum. I mean, you know, come on. And so what? So now we're just giving it to the museums like for, you know, a write-up in a mezcla, like
yeah,
I know.
I feel you. That's okay.
Meet the Latinx artist that uses hot Cheetos to blah 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 blah.
I mean, my gosh, I know.
You know, it's like
meet the Latinx artist that does giant piñatas. That was me.
I know her. I know her. Well, you know, but it, you know, it's like eventually it just becomes fluff, right? It's
yeah.
Like, then we just start. So then we start doing it for that. Like, we just start doing it for that kind of notoriety, right? Because it's easy and it's like, access,
yeah.
you know? But do we all need access? Like, do we, you know, do we all need to be front and center? Like, probably not. And I'm okay with not being front and center or well-liked.
I want to ask you one last question is, like, for your work, for your research, what is something that you want to work on, like a dream project for you to work on?
Oh my God.
Or mm-hmm. like, what are you looking forward to producing? Like, what do you want to do next?
Well, I'm looking forward to producing with my friend Dino again.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked together here in the city in the October. I produced a play called The Homophobes, which was written by Argentinian playwright named Susana Cook, and Dino Dinko directed. And it was kind of his concept. And I just kind of rolled with it because I respect him. And we go way back. I met him when back in my arena days, you know, like
yeah.
we were really young. And so I've known him for a really long time. And I kind of just blindly went into the project and ended up having a really good time. And I love theater, you know, like I love theater. I love that atmosphere and that excitement and that energy. And then watching creative people just unravel in front of you is fucking beautiful. And so we're talking about putting it on again next summer. And so I'm excited to work on that again with him.
Oh,
and,
exciting.
Yeah. And so I'll let you know when that happens. And it was just like a really funny, irreverent, like it was a really cool piece. A dream project would be, so my first sexual experiences were through party lines.
Oh, shit.
And so,
yes.
And so I'm interested in both researching that media and that type of media and that medium. And I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Can you explain party lines though really quick?
Yeah. So I'm thinking of a very specific kind because there's different ones. There's the ones that you would see in the magazines and you would call the 900 number and it was like, you know. a chat roulette, right? And so, but there was some that in LA specifically, I can only speak for LA, I'm sure they were everywhere, but they were like the Latino one, right? And it was like a chat roulette, but it was like real people, like you would hook up. And like, so it was kind of like Scruff or Grindr, but like on phone lines, right? And like, and you would, and the thing is, what really makes me want to like continue like do this work is the performance involved.
Yeah,
you know, in how like people would code switch and change their voices and talk in deep voices and like hyper masculine, and like you could just kind of like embody whatever you thought would make someone want to have sex with you, basically. But it was always this very like machismo, like cholo aesthetics, right? Like all of these things. And so and then also the friends that you make through those and the communities you make through those. And like, I'm interested in that. Like, it was a really big part of like my awakening sexually, and like it got me in a lot of trouble, but it was also, it's like something that we don't really talk about.
I still remember, there used to be party lines in Las Vegas too. Mm-hmm. And I remember going on them.
Yeah.
When I was like my first couple years of college, when I still like had a flip phone. So there was no internet on your phone yet. I've never talked about that before. Yeah, that was an interesting. It was interesting.
I met some really cool people. I met some really scary people. Like I said, you know, just fucking jump in cars, right? Like you're just like, all right, let's go. Like, because there was no other way. There's no other way to connect. And so like, that would be like a fun, interesting personal project.
Yeah, I love that.
To like both research it, talk to people some more about it that have experienced it, and then it could be some type of like an installation, right?
Yeah. Or like, and maybe find some misconnections.
Right?
Yeah, that could be really cool. That's exciting.
Yeah.
And like the audio component of it too. That would be so great if you found some audio.
Like, let's just think of the fact that these were like landlines.
Yeah.
And like we had very different, like the phones were, it's like media archaeology, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this whole other like layer to it. Really interesting.
Yeah. Well, Juan, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you.
This was so much fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
And thank you for these Cheetos.
Oh, your ASMR.
Yeah, can you want to do it with me?
Sure. Oh, my God.
Okay. We're going to end with some ASMR. Okay, we're done. You can follow Juan on Instagram at @no_controles. That's NONCONTROLES. If you're in the Bay Area, check out the exhibition Chosen Familias at the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco, co-curated by Juan Fernandez himself. Send me your emails. If you have any questions or you want some advice, please send your emails to artpeoplepod@gmail.com, and I might read them on a future episode. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and if you like what you've heard, please make sure you rate and review the show. You can follow us on social media @artpeoplepod. Today's episode was produced and edited by me, Justin Favela, with music by Mike McDonald. A few quick announcements. This July 20th at the Barrick Museum of Art, you can go check out the show Sorry for the Mess by yours truly and Ramiro Gomez. And we'll be doing a community day. So meet me there from 12 to 5 p.m. We'll be doing a paper plant workshop. And there'll be many other things going on that day. Again, the Marjorie Barrick Museum on July 20th, all day. Parking is free that day on campus, so even if it's staff parking, I know a lot of people that go to UNLV are afraid to park in those spots because they do ticket, but not on that day. All right, Marjorie Barrick Museum, July 20th. See y'all there. Also, shout out to the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. I just did an installation there. What a beautiful, amazing community. I hope to go back there and do some more work, chat with the people there. They were incredible. So if you're in the area, in the Bay Area, again, go down to Santa Cruz, check out the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. I did an installation there honoring Eduardo Carrillo, a really amazing Chicano muralist that was part of the community there for many years. One of his murals was erased in the 1970s, and we brought it back to life. So again, thank you so much to the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. Okay, that's it. Bye-bye. Well, I hope you all enjoyed that. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Juan. That was such a great time. And also want to let y'all know that that interview was done a long time ago, over 6 months ago. So much has changed. Juan told me he's a whole different person now. So you know what? There will probably be another official Juan Fernandez interview on Latinos Who Lunch again in the future. So thank you. And yeah, if you, again, if you're in the Bay Area, if you're in San Francisco, check out the show that Juan helped curate. And then also, if you are near Santa Cruz, please visit the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. Check them out. I will be doing a lot of traveling in the next year. So if you are in Des Moines, Iowa, I will be in Des Moines, Iowa next week. Hit me up on Instagram. Let's hang out. Let's go eat. Also, I will be in Fort Worth, Texas, all of August or most of August and September at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art. So if anybody wants to help or hang out, please let me know. Mostly help, because I'm gonna be tired. I know I will, and I'm not gonna want to go out at night. But if y'all want to come through and check it out, let me know. So total shameless plug. If y'all want to go see some of my artwork, I have several installations up at the moment. If you are in Houston, Texas, the Houston Center for Contemporary Craft has a show up right now. Mine is called Justin Favela, All You Can Eat. It's all about Tex-Mex food and Tex-Mex history, which is really fun. I made giant nachos, giant fajitas, margaritas, a combination plate, a puffy taco, chile con carne, and it's all like Honey, I Blew Up the Kid size, which is really fun. Or Honey, I Shrunk the Kid. I don't know. One of those white people movies. Okay. And then if you're in Pennsylvania, the Berman Museum has one of my installations up right now in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. That's near Philly. The installation is up through July 28th. It's called The Valley of Oaxaca. Go check that out. If you're in New York, Sugar Hill Children's Museum of Art and Storytelling has one of my installations up through September. Go, that's a really great museum. Check them out. Let's see, what else? Again, the Marjorie Barrick Museum of Art has the show up right now. Sorry for the mess, with myself and Ramiro Gomez. And again, join us for the Community Day on July 20th. Okay, I think that's enough. And as always, you can visit us at latinoswholunch.com. You can send us letters, emails, voice messages to asklwl@gmail.com. If you have a minute, please review us 5 stars. 5 stars only, because the more reviews we get, the more visible we are. And visibility leads to representation, and representation matters. Today's episode was produced and edited by Justin Favela. The music you're hearing right now is by the band Brownout. I'm Favi Fav. Bye-bye.